Our next speaker is my colleague, Edmund J. McMahon. He's a senior fellow for tax and budgetary studies at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research. He's also the director of the Institute's Empire Center for New York State Policy and is really your host here this morning. EJ joined the Manhattan Institute 7 years ago. His professional background includes more than 25 years as a policymaker and analyst of New York's variety of roles, including deputy commissioner for tax policy analysis and counselor to the commissioner in the State Department of Taxation and Finance. He was director of the minority staff of the State Assembly Ways and Means Committee and director of research for the Business Council's research arm, the Public Policy Institute. Prior to that, he was a political writer, columnist, state capitol reporter for the Albany Times Union and the Knickerbocker News. Please join me in welcoming EJ McMahon.
Thank you very much, and good morning, everyone. I'll move right into my role in this presentation, which is to illustrate and provide some background on some of the points that Terry O'Neill, my co-author, made in his presentation. And if you'll excuse me, I'll... As Howard said in the outset in his presentation, there's been big changes in the complexion and in the mix of the of union membership and union density in the United States. When the Taylor Law and laws like it were being considered and enacted in the mid-1960s, one-third of all workers were unionized in New York State. And most of those workers were in the private sector. There's been big changes since then, obviously. In the 1970s, in particular in the 1980s, there was a significant continuing decline in union density in the private sector. If you were to graph it, which I haven't for this purpose, it goes downhill quite steadily and steeply. During that same period, of course, we had a pronounced increase in the growth of union density in state and local government across the country. And this same trend happened in New York, but as in so many other areas, it happened in New York merely in a more pronounced fashion. New York, as of now, is the most heavily unionized state in the country in terms of both the private and public sector workforce combined. Nearly half of all working union members in New York State work in the public sector. That includes a small federal government piece, a very small one. And as you can see, that's illustrated here. So New York is, overall, New York's workforce, private and public, is twice as heavily unionized as a national norm, and roughly half of it is in the public sector, mostly state and local government. The ratio is the proportion is 69% of public sector employees belong to unions. For complicated reasons, there's some data limitations used in producing that estimate by the guys who do that. It's probably higher than 69%, but that's the best analysis available. It's probably more like 85 to 90%. Again, that is twice the national average. The national average for unionization in the public sector is roughly 35 or 36%. Again, the estimates tend to be low in heavily unionized states and high in less unionized states, so it evens out. Now, here's an interesting trace of the trend over time. And the data used here are wages and salaries paid to state and local government workers as a percentage of all state wages and salaries in the state compared to the U.S. That is, this kind of gives you a good sense of both the size and the compensation level of the state and local government workforce relative to the total workforce in New York State and in the U.S. over a very long period of time, 77 years. And if you look at this chart, what you see is that New York was closely aligned with the rest of the nation for much of the period leading up to the mid-1960s. There were a few periods, for instance, briefly in the Depression and during the war, when New York's public sector share was larger than a national average. But you'll see those lines being very close and touching right up to the late 50s, really, and 60s. Begins to open up when Mayor Wagner grants collective bargaining rights to the cities. Workers in the late 1950s, and then and what's missed here, this is one of these little software glitches that happen when you transfer things to PowerPoint. There would have been an arrow there right in 1967, but when it opens up basically as the Taylor Law passes and that gap opens up, and what you see is over the next 20 plus years there's a period where the proportion of wages and salaries paid to state and local government workers in New York is significantly higher, full percentage points higher, a couple of points, than the national average. Then you see toward the end of the period, more recent years, what seems to be a sort of a convergence between the rest of the country and the U.S. So the question is, so has the state and local government share of all wages and salaries paid in New York begun to drop relatively, or is something else going on? Well, the answer is that something else is going on, and it's in the denominator. There's been such an incredible surge in compensation in the finance, insurance, and real estate sector, principally the securities industry, within the past 10 years, that it has begun to distort comparisons like this. This is not something that's been going on for the whole period. It's more recent, since the 1990s in particular. 23% of all wages and salaries in New York State are paid through what we used to be called the FIRE sector, finance, insurance, and real estate. And it's less than half of that nationally. In fact, there's very few states other than Connecticut and New Jersey where it's even 10%. If you back the FIRE sector out, what you see is, you look at state and local government wages as a percent of all wages other than finance sector wages, what you see is, again, that gap opened up, and it stayed pretty wide. Our public sector got bigger, state and local government sector got bigger, and stayed bigger. So while roughly half the states have comprehensive collective bargaining laws, and most of them allow some degree of unionization and collective bargaining by their public employees, and in almost every state, public employee unions are quite politically influential. In New York, it's been an exceptionally strong outcome, as reflected in both the number and in the pay levels, or the pay share, rather, of state and local government employees. Also, this is, if you reflect this in the growth of employment, as Howard mentioned, throughout the country, this has been a national trend. The story of the last 40 years, and in the post-war era leading up to that, has been as one of the great stories what's been going on in America is the great expansion of state and local government, of government at every level. And so there's been a huge expansion of the number of people working in state and local government throughout the country. Part of this is simply a reflection of the increase in population across the country. 122% increase. Compared to a 110% increase in private sector payrolls nationwide. So in other words, government has grown about 20% faster than the private sector over the past 40 years. So if you spread that over 40 years, it's a relatively minor or slow incremental increase in government related to the private sector. In New York, state and local government employment over the past 40 years is up twice as much as private sector employment. And if you look at those trends charted together, what you see is it's gone up in state and local government more or less steadily, with a few exceptions, a few dips. The first dip during the 70s fiscal crisis, the next during the early 90s fiscal crisis, whereas private sector payrolls have been on something of a roller coaster ride. They've dipped quite deeply, surged, dipped again. Most recently, if you look at those last few years, we had a syndrome between 2001 and 2006 where we had a period there for a while where we had lost jobs in the wake of the recession and the World Trade Center attack. The public sector payrolls held steady. Another way of looking at the headcount, we have more state and local government employees per 1,000 residents than any of the 10 most populous states, 14% more than the national average. We rank 11th by this measure. The only states with higher per capita employment in state local government tend to be small, sparsely populated, or largely agricultural states. Places that don't have mature, diverse economies tend to have larger state and local government sectors. Here's a quick view of wages and salaries. This is an area you could have a whole day-long symposium just on this, by the way. There's quite a lot of discussion and research done over the years at paring down into the figures for average salaries and comparing them for specific same or similar or dissimilar positions. I'll just summarize. Just in general, what these studies usually find is that state and local government generally pay more for like positions when adjusted on an hourly basis, with the exception of some highly trained professional positions where the private sector definitely pays more. That's a whole other area of discussion we might get into briefly during the Q&A, but there's a lot of research that's been done on that I'd be happy to talk about on the side. But in terms of overall averages, the state average private sector salary is pumped up quite significantly again by the securities industry and the finance sector. If you take that out, if you take the finance sector out, which pays an average of $170,000 per job, and look at the statewide private sector, excluding that sector, the private sector statewide pays somewhat slightly less on average than state and local government. And then if you look at all private sector jobs, and that regional comparison is all private sector jobs, by region, what you see is that in 8 of the 10 commonly designated regions of New York, state and local government on average pays higher salaries than private sector. And it's interesting that the difference is largest in Long Island, a region you might not think that's true since it's a high-cost region with relatively high private sector salaries. Nonetheless, the difference between state and local government salaries and private sector salary is the second highest after the North Country, the Adirondacks, is in Long Island, where the average state and local government wage is 23% higher than the average private sector wage. I'm going to pass over these roughly. This was a designation the feds were doing until last year, which they broke it down by white-collar occupations and blue-collar occupations. And on most of those, not all and not in all regions, the public sector workers were earning more on an hourly basis. Here's a view of benefits. This is one of many slides I have here that actually would serve quite well to promote a union dues increase, because to a great extent, this shows just how successful public employees have been in New York. And basically, by every measure that matters to a working person, how much vacation, how many paid holidays, do I have access to retirement benefits, what kind of retirement benefits do I have, health benefits, how extensive are the health benefits, can I get dental and visual as well as major medical. On every step, basically, government employees have more access to more benefits, more paid time off, more leave, better retirement benefits than private sector workers. And this, of course, is in addition to and beyond the wage. One thing that this chart does not show is, of course, the ultimate benefit, which is job security. All civil servants in New York State, not just teachers, have tenure. And that's been the case for over 50 years. Layoffs in the public sector are exceedingly rare and always targeted at only the most junior employees, with very, very few exceptions. And that job security is something that obviously many people put a great dollar value on, and understandably so. Here's another look at a long-term trend. New York State's long-term tax burden. We hear a lot about how we have the heaviest or almost the heaviest state and local taxes in the country. I always, bending over backwards here, tend to look at it relative to personal income rather than just per capita in order to show what our tax burden is relative to ability to pay and affordability, and we rank high in that level too. We haven't always. It's very interesting if you go back in time to the earliest era where this data is commonly available. From the late 50s through the early 60s, we were between 9 and 11% higher than the national average, and we're not close to the top 10 among all states. This was not a high-tax state before the mid-60s. Repeat, New York State was never a high-tax state before the mid-60s. And two things happen. You look at that gap open there, which my friend Bob Ward has suggested is, you might call it the Rockefeller spike in the mid-60s. Two things happen there. One is the creation of New York State's Medicaid program, which anticipated the federal Medicaid program and was a budget blowout from the very beginning. The second was the Taylor Law. Those two things happened almost at once, within 2 years of each other, and you see the result there. Our tax burden relative to the national average shot up and has stayed up ever since. It got the gap was narrowest in the late 90s, but has widened again recently. The key, if there was one single purpose, overriding goal that Nelson Rockefeller and the framers of the law had in mind, or that motivated the political response that took the form of the Taylor Law, it was to end strikes. I'm closely paraphrasing what Rockefeller said after the transit strike. This must not happen again. It was a never again moment. We've got to do something. We've got to stop this. Now, there's an irony here. It was agreed that we had these strikes in New York City, including the one depicted on the cover of our report today, which was a 1962 one-day UFT strike, kind of one of the famous ones. And after a series of strikes culminating in a welfare strike and the transit strike, the response from Albany, and you can read this in the remarks of the time and in the political, in the newspapers, et cetera, was We have got to give employees collective bargaining rights and bring order to this. Now, ironically, the labor unrest was greatest in New York City, where employees had collective bargaining rights and the beginnings of a framework of a collective bargaining system, very rudimentary. But the Taylor Law was adopted and was state of the art, and very, very wisely did not micromanage the process also. It very carefully steered away from micromanaging all the details of what would be bargained and what wouldn't, and was generally considered a very kind of wise solution to this. Now, there's an irony. The Taylor Law is enacted, and almost immediately there's a huge surge of strikes. There's strikes all over the place, over half of them by teachers. There were well over 200 strikes in the first 15 years of the Taylor Law's existence. Again, probably 60% of them, I didn't double-check the math this morning, were teacher strikes, though, all over the state. And meanwhile, in the rest of the country, you also see there's strike activity continuing in both the private and public sector. The long-term federal stats measure only large employers, but some of the partial stats show similar trends among all employers. This continues through the 1970s, right up to 1981, 1982, and suddenly, all the numbers just fall right out of bed. There's no more strikes. They're basically indexed to the same level. There's less than 10% as many strikes on the national level of all kinds. There are years, there have been many years in the past 25 years when there have been no strikes at all in New York State in the public sector, or very few, or limited job actions. People have looked at this and have all sorts of reasons for it. One event that happened in 1981-82 that's impossible to ignore was Reagan's handling of the air traffic controller strike, which was very popular with the public, where he, you may recall, he simply fired all the striking workers and replaced them, which critics said would bring on chaos, and which in effect was seen as an abject lesson. There also were economic and other changes going on at the time, the decline of unionization, global competition, corporate reorganization, all these factors come into play. And then I suggest one other one, which is the Triborough Amendment is passed, and basically public sector unions have pretty much what they need, and there is much less need to strike, that the 70s was an era of establishing a vying to get the framework set up to in a way that would achieve the union's goals. And I think if you look at compensation in any way and a lot of other factors, I think the conclusion has to be that the unions largely succeeded, that the strikes were very much worth it from the union's point of view, despite the Taylor Law penalties. Now we're going to go into two issues that Terry raised. One is arbitration. These are PERB stats. If you track settlements during the late 90s, for instance, you find that the settlements, the contract agreements for police and fire covered by the interest arbitration provisions are consistently a half a percentage point or more above that of non-uniformed employees in municipalities, and closely rival those won by teachers who are negotiating under different circumstances. Now, in negotiations, so many people in this room are involved in them, a half a percentage point is not an insignificant thing, especially compounded over a series of years. This also can be traced if you look at the average salaries as measured by the retirement system, where you see just in the last 10 years a significantly higher increase in salaries for members of the police and fire retirement system. This is all outside New York City in this case, than for other employees not in the police and fire retirement system. The members of the police and fire retirement system, by definition, virtually all are in the category of employees who have binding interest arbitration as part of their legal package. One other aspect, if you look at where things now stand, average salaries for different types of employees, and this is by category again, you see that state police make almost twice as much as non-uniformed state employees, although there's some correction officers in that non-uniform number. The counties, as you may have guessed, is principally Long Island police, making an average of $122,000 a year, including overtime. Although the way their hours are structured, overtime is defined differently than it might be for you or I. Cities, and this is largely the struggling upstate cities, they're higher too. Now let's go on to the Triborough effect. Here's a typical, this is based on the Suffolk County median. This is a typical salary lane schedule. Although for a teacher, it probably looks more like this. In other words, if you're doing the things needed to move up the lanes, which many teachers do, you're going up steps. You're not facing one of these four lanes. You're kind of moving like that. One thing that made me think of this, I'll go beyond that, we illustrate in the report how this affects a teacher and how much more a teacher can make over even after many years of working under no contract. I noticed a photo in one of our local papers, and these are teachers at Chalmont picketing last week because they've been working for a year without a contract. And something caught my interest, and that was the sign the guy on the left is carrying. And I thought, test scores up. They have good test scores, Chalmont. Salaries down. Now, you're a parent driving down around past the school, and you kind of like the school and the teacher. You think, boy, salaries down. That's not fair. What's going on? Well, salaries are not down. The teachers in Chalmont actually are on a step schedule, which in its frozen status calls for pay increases averaging 3.4% a year. And that's most of the teachers, except the most senior teachers who've gone beyond the top of the scale, which is step 25 here. And this doesn't illustrate all of the lanes or the added $5,000 stipend on top of the lanes if you get national certification. So here were the reforms that Terry went through. I won't review them in detail. He mentioned three major categories dealing with arbitration, tri-borough, and fixing these PERB rulings. I'd like to add one other set of reforms that I'd like to suggest going back that frankly draws on experiences that I've had going back to being a reporter 30 plus years ago dealing with school district negotiations then and with the frustration of a common newspaper reader today and somebody following my own towns. And that is that I think we need a truth in contracting statute in New York State so that there'd be full public disclosure in advance of ratification of what all the costs associated with a proposed collective bargaining agreement, that you'd start by reporting the cost baselines for the crucial aspects of terms and condition of employment, those that can be measured directly and indirectly. And lest this be seen as a costly local mandate, that there should be a package developed through the comptroller's office at state expense to assist localities in developing this initial baseline, and the comptroller's office also should develop the accounting model for the impact expenditures, and that this should become a routine part of the deliberations and the reporting of collective bargaining agreements in New York State. I'll close there. I know that to allow some time for questions before we go on. Thank you very much.
Okay, we do have some time for questions, either for EJ or for Terry O'Neill. Please approach the microphone, and if you would, what's that? A little bit more than 5 minutes, so make it a punchy question. Approach the microphone and give your name and your institutional affiliation. Questions? Well, I'll just take the prerogative of the chair then and ask either of you. You've endorsed reforms, but there is a broader question lurking in the background, which is why reform? And you've kind of implied why reform, but I wonder if you might want to address the underlying motive behind reform. Some might say New York's ahead of the rest of the nation. It's a more progressive state, and the problem is that the rest of the country is not where New York has lifted itself. Thoughts?
Reverse seniority in light of what we're doing here.
I think that would get into the issue, which I would expect we'll get into in the next panel also, of the, well, are we getting higher quality services? And that is, to use the old catchphrase, beyond the scope of our report, because that's a whole other subject. But there's a whole lot of other work that's been done to suggest that we're not necessarily getting higher quality services as measured by the added level of taxes that we pay. The governor has used the phrase perfect storm of unaffordability to describe the challenges facing New York, and in particular upstate New York. And that perfect storm of unaffordability includes exceptionally heavy tax burdens. In upstate New York, 9 of the most 10 heavily taxed counties in the country in property tax terms relative to property home values are in upstate New York. Downstate New York, it's a whole other issue. Those problems are a direct reflection of the cost of government. And I think that things have evolved to a point in New York where we're basically in a position where we move forward on a default basis on many of these contracts, and that employers lack the flexibility they need to be more creative and to chase the kind of savings they need to make. And I also think there's one point I'd like to echo strongly that Terry made, which is a big point here, and a big point that's reflected in my last suggestion, which is mine, on the truth in contracting, is accountability. And that we've drifted to a point now where I think that in many cases that we lack sufficient accountability in New York, because in too many cases, in fact, employers can simply point to arbitration or to the Taylor law in general and just say, my hands are tied, I can't do anything. There's nothing I can actually achieve here. And I think that more attention needs to be paid to this issue, and more serious concern needs to be shown for this issue, particularly by the legislature, which I think in the package it passed last year seemed to indicated that perhaps it was living in some other state. So that's
Terry, anything to add?
Well, you know, from a Long Island perspective, I grew up in Queens, and when I moved out to Long Island, you saw, you know, hundreds of little Republicans. I'm a registered Democrat, so it's not a party issue, but it was a one-party system on Long Island. There really was just Republicans, and all these people cleaning up the parks, and you could eat off the street. I mean, it was a terrifically, the physical plants were beautiful everywhere. They're not that way anymore. It looks more like Queens did when I lived there. The services have diminished. The taxes are unbelievable, and people, you know, can't retire there anymore. We have a committee addressing the drain brain from Long Island. They get it worse. I've lost it before, but the young
your brain was drained.
Right, the young adults who are graduating from college, they can't come back to Long Island. They can't afford to live there. There was just an article the other day. They either have to live with their parents, which after you get out of college is not so easy, or you have to live in a basement apartment. They basically were saying those are the two options. And that's probably true for about 80% of them. So they don't come back, and that's not a good thing, because we do have very good schools. You know, we have a good gene pool there, but we have wonderful schools, but they're unbelievably expensive. And like I said before, I asked the lady when we were getting ready for negotiations, what percent of this budget are personnel-related costs? 82%. So the only place you're going to control those costs and your taxes are by controlling those contracts which generate the money. And they're very well paid now, and they just got to slow down. You know, we're not living for the employees. The government is supposed to take care of everybody else, not just the employees.
Great. Join me in thanking EJ and Terry. I stay up and keep going, right?